as the longest barrier island in the world. Back then, North Padre was a sleepy little seaside spot that didn't qualify as a proper town. Even today, it has escaped large-scale commercial development and seems happy to be overshadowed by the more famous and more raucous South Padre Island, which is favored by college students on spring break. For me, North Padre was a place of perpetual swimsuits, bare feet, days on end with not a care in the world. Throughout my childhood, we visited the condo often. My mom and two older brothers and I spent most of our summers there, with my dad coming down for weekends and when he could get away from his law practice for more extended stays. Many of my most vivid memories are set on Padre. Beachcombing with my mom, loved the coast more than any of us. Roasting marshmallows at the bonfires that my dad hosted for friends and any passersby who fall prey to his promise of hot dogs and the singing of songs of World Wars I and II. Fishing for sharks and redfish and speckled trout, playing in the dunes and swimming. Experiencing my first real kiss, which happened on a warm late summer evening, somewhere around the 7th or 8th grade. She was a pretty girl, I think, from Seguin. I also remember surfing and skateboarding and skimboarding, and later experimenting with beer, Boone Farm, and the like. There are less idyllic memories, too. I recall the oily globs that inundated the beach after the Hitchcock 1 well blew out 50 miles off the Gulf Coast of Mexico in the summer of 1979, quickly spread massive quantities of oil to U.S. waters. Somewhere I still have a small mustard jar containing a sample of the gooey sludge that I collected that year. I also have vivid memories of impaling my foot on the nail-like spine of a dead gaff-top catfish that had washed ashore. A doctor friend of my parents dislodged the fish, which was stuck in whole, and applied enough pressure to my appendage that a stream of blood spurted out in a 3-foot-long arc. And I remember Hurricane Allen, a Category 5 beast that struck in 1980, destroying the old wooden Bob Hall Pier, a favored fishing spot, and wrecking large sections of the immense concrete seawall that runs along the beach in front of the Gulf Stream. But despite such episodes, what I remember most are a lot of very good times. My affection for Padre Island notwithstanding, it doesn't get a lot of love from the rest of the world. None of Texas's seashores do. They never make those lists of the world's greatest beaches, not the 10 best, not the 25 best, not even the 100 best. And that's okay. Really, the omissions are not unwarranted. After all, there are no picturesque cliffs to offer vertical contrast to the relative flatness of the terrain. Water is as often as not a dingy brown color. Surfing is hardly world-class, and there's almost always an overabundance of trash strewn about. Plus, thanks to the Texas Open Beaches Act, large numbers of vehicles often congest the shoreline. It's not an image the design directors of glossy travel magazines think of when it's time to choose a cover. Nevertheless, I love it. One reason is the people I've met there. Throughout my early years, I made lasting friendships with other part-time residents, kids who hailed from Corpus Christi and farther-flung places like Laredo, Houston, Dallas, Chicago, and Mexico City. We've attended each other's graduations, weddings, and celebrated the births of each other's children. My North Padre friends came to the funerals of my mother and my father and my brother, and unfortunately, I've attended a few for their parents. These relationships have continued with the next generation. My daughter, Sarah, who is 17 years old, is friends with the children of the children I met so long ago. Counting my parents and my friends' parents, that's 3 generations of island amity. But I've got great friends in Austin, too, at Temple and other places of varying degrees of flungness. North Padre's unique attraction for me is the island itself, despite what all those snooty list makers think. The sand, though often littered, is fine and white, and the water, though often murky, sometimes clear and green. Either way, it's almost always inviting and almost always full of fish, and the seashells are usually plentiful. Our condo, a cozy little space, is filled with the bounty of the many beachcombing walks that my family has taken over the course of 5 decades. Recently, to commemorate the 50 years I've spent enjoying sandy adventures on the coast, I decided to do something befitting the occasion. I decided to take a long walk on the beach. A very long walk. I decided to do something I've never done before, something I'm not sure anyone has ever done before. Beachcomb the entire length of the Padre Island National Seashore. All 65 miles of it. For the unfamiliar, PINS, or PINS as the locals referred to it, is a national park made up of a 203-square-mile middle section of Padre Island, stretching from about 10 miles south of Packery Channel, which connects the Gulf to Laguna Madre and Corpus Christi Bay, all the way down to the Port Mansfield Channel, which connects the Gulf to Laguna Madre at tiny Port Mansfield. The expanse of national seashore that I plan to walk is the longest stretch of undeveloped barrier island in the world. Save for the visitor center and a few semi-primitive campsites near the park's entrance at its north end, it's totally wild. There's nothing. No bathrooms, no showers, no water stations. A walk of this sort would, I figured, probably take somewhere between 3 and 5 days, depending on weather conditions and beach conditions, which can vary greatly and change rapidly. Soft sand, high winds, or high tides would make for hard trekking. Soft sand, high winds, and high tides would make for miserable, even impossible trekking. I was looking at April as a good time to make the trip after the spring break crowds had dispersed, but before it got too hot, well before hurricane season, which runs from June through November. I began planning accordingly, thinking about logistics, making a packing list, and keeping an eye on the weather forecasts, beach conditions, and tide charts. What I failed to consider was that a global pandemic would bring almost everything to a grinding halt. March 17th, as the world was beginning to shut down, PINS announced that the park would remain open, but that the visitor's center would be closing. Nearby restrooms would stay open too, but all interpretive programming would be canceled until further notice. Then Governor Greg Abbott announced his first COVID-19-related executive orders. There were four of them, and they marked the beginning of the shutdown in Texas. I knew it might not be long before the park closed entirely, so I thought it wise to expedite things and move my trip up to late March. I had decided early on that the best approach to a marathon beachcomb like this was to be as physically unburdened as possible. Carrying a pack full of gear and a 3 to 5 day supply of water and food wouldn't have felt right for the leisurely, albeit lengthy, stroll I was envisioning. And honestly, it may have been more than my 53-year-old, not super athletic body was up to. So I asked photographer Kenny Braun if he and his assistant, Paul Andries, could come along and act as both documentarians and support crew. The idea was that I'd walk the length of the beach and they'd drive it, carrying all of our gear, food, water, and beer in two vehicles, one of which was my trusty old midsize four-wheel drive Toyota SUV. We would rendezvous every 10 miles or so at lunchtime and then again around dinner time, at which point we'd make camp for the evening. In between, Kenny and Paul were free to scout good spots for overnighting, to swim, surf, fish, play bocce ball, or whatever. Kenny, a noted surf photographer, thought this sounded like a pretty good deal. And so, in late March, we set off for an epic coastal excursion that would allow me to spend my days immersed in the fine art of beachcombing and my nights beneath a starry South Texas sky. While the rest of the world was hunkering down in isolation, I was going to partake in some social distancing of a different sort. Shortly after 10 in the morning, Ken and Paul dropped me off on the beach at the line of bollards that marks the park's north boundary, and then made their way back to the main road, the paved Park Road 22. Shouldering a small knapsack containing water, a few snacks, a small towel, and sunscreen, I headed south. Conditions couldn't have been better. Temperature was a mild 70-something with a forecast calling for a high of 82. There was a pleasant onshore breeze blowing maybe 20 miles per hour, and the skies were slightly overcast with a hint of fog. To my left, Gulf water was extraordinarily green, and the 2 to 3 foot breakers produced a beautifully contrasting white seafoam. Beach sand was packed and firm, and the tides were favorable. Seagulls cawed, and long squadrons of brown pelicans wheeled silently overhead. Sun would set at 7:42 p.m. PINS contains 5 rather unimaginatively named beaches. At the northernmost end, there's a short stretch known as North Beach, which is followed by Closed Beach, named because it is closed to automobile traffic, and then South Beach, which runs down to Port Mansfield Channel and contains both Little Shell Beach and Big Shell Beach. From the north end of South Beach down to the channel, mile markers are placed every 5 miles. During that first mile along North Beach, I was struck with a great sense of relief. I took in deep breaths of fresh, briny air, and my worries about the fate of the rest of the world melted away beneath the emerging sun. Then, as I made my way down Closed Beach, a sense of solitude began to set in, allowing me to acclimate to my new environments and begin the necessary work of getting my footing, both physical and mental. I didn't see a soul the first hour. Shortly afterward, I came upon a small crew of park rangers gathered around something of interest. I approached, and a friendly ranger explained that volunteers were being trained to locate and collect turtle eggs. Hens is the most important nesting ground in the country for Kemp's Ridley sea turtles, the world's most endangered species of sea turtle. And it is home to the Division of Sea Turtle Science and Recovery, the only organization of its kind in the U.S. National Park System. In a matter of days, the ranger explained, the beleaguered turtles, one of five species found in the Gulf of Mexico, would begin to emerge from the sea and make their way up into the dunes to lay eggs. The ranger bent down and made a series of little check marks in the sand to show me what sea turtles' tracks look like. Every year, from April to July, rangers and volunteers work diligently to spy such tracks, which lead to the nests from which they will collect eggs and then care for them as they hatch throughout the summertime. As the silver dollar-sized hatchlings emerge from their shells, park staffers release them in large batches onto the beach, where they instinctually inch their way to the sea. Male turtles will likely never leave the water again, but the females, after roaming thousands of miles, will somehow manage to return in a dozen or so years to the same beach where they were born to lay their own eggs. It's an astonishing process, and I've taken Sarah to see a few of the releases over the years. They are something to behold, especially for a father accompanying his own young hatchling. A little sidebar here. Is it safe to gather at the water? At a time of extreme heat, Texans long to visit our beaches and lakes. The pandemic has made it difficult to keep track of ever-changing closures and reopenings and reclosures. Stay up to date on where you can and can't go for a refreshing dip. Visit www.texasmonthly.com/water, which will update as conditions change. Back to our text. Thank the ranger, wish her good luck, and continue walking past the Malachite Campground Closed Visitor Center, and then entered South Beach, where I encountered a few RVers, tent campers, and a smattering of day trippers. There were also the occasional surf fishers, many of whom I surmised from their out-of-state license plates were winter Texans who had not yet begun their spring migration back to their Midwest summering grounds. I noticed a Michigander's couple's toes in the surf, ass in the sand license plate frame. They just reeled in a nice redfish, 21 inches, just into keeper territory, they told me excitedly. Before I knew it, 2 o'clock, and I'd reached mile marker 5, with the goal of mile marker 15 by the end of the day, which actually marked 10 miles of walking for me, since the markers don't start until you hit the drivable portion of the park at South Beach. Kenny and Paul were there, relaxing in the shade of a canopy. We had lunch of oranges, trail mix, grilled sausages and cheese wrapped in tortillas. I grabbed a cold Modelo and kicked off my shoes to wade in the cool water, which felt good on my already tired feet. We assessed my progress thus far and noted the light crowds for such a beautiful day, which we figured probably owed to the coronavirus, coupled with the fact it was a Monday. I soon refilled my water bottle, laced my shoes back up, said goodbye to Kenny and Paul, and started walking again. The beach was not only light on visitors, but it was also unusually light on trash. Texas beaches are almost always littered with all manner of natural and human-made debris. The fault for this lies not solely with our residents, who by and large know better than to mess with Texas, but with the interplay of coastal geography and ocean currents. Our coast, and particularly this bending portion of it, is positioned where two opposing wind-driven sea currents meet, pushing marine debris from all over the Gulf and beyond onto the beaches in a constant deluge. This particular stretch was likely so clean because the annual Billy Sandifer Big Shell Beach Cleanup, the 25th such event organized by the nonprofit Friends of Padre, had taken place less than a month earlier. Some 1,500 volunteers had spread out over 33 miles of beach and in a single day hauled out 60 tons of trash in 4 industrial-sized dumpsters. It's a Sisyphean task. The trash will accumulate once again, and there'll be another 60 or so tons to pick up next year. But even weeks later, the salutary effects of the hard work were still apparent. The same natural influences that dump all this debris onto the beaches have a more beneficent result, too. They bring to shore seashells and other naturally occurring objects, such as driftwood and seaweed, which is good for the health of the beach, preventing erosion, providing sustenance for wildlife, although it sometimes arrives in quantities too large and malodorous to be fully appreciated. Penn's is known for excellent shelling. I collected hundreds of shells from these shores as a child, and I expected to find no shortage of good specimens on this trip. With more than 10 miles in the proverbial rearview mirror, I was empty-handed. I had seen sundry bits of human detritus, such as a soccer ball at which, in an ode to the movie Castaway, I yelled, "Wilson!" I had also seen a deceased pufferfish and some fragments of shells and sand dollars, but to my surprise, I'd come across nothing worth picking up. I was approaching Little Shell Beach, though, and I thought that surely a beach so named would be awash with shells, even if they were little ones. I looked forward to angel wings, Atlantic Bay scallops, disc docinias, common arcs, Florida spiny jewel boxes, pinas, giant Atlantic cockles, lettered olives, sand dollars, sawtooth pen shells, and scotch bonnets. And, of course, the prized lightning whelk, the official shell of Texas, which is, at least in my experience, quite elusive. Lightning whelk's scientific name is Byzikon perversum pollie. Byzikon comes from the Greek word for large fig and roughly describes the shell's overall shape. Perversum comes from the Latin word for turned the wrong way and refers to the lightning whelk's unusual left-sided opening, which makes it easily identifiable. And pollie honors the late Texas teacher, naturalist, and malacologist, Dr. T.E. Pulley. The lightning in the shell's common name is an ode to the distinctive stripes that run along its sides. My hopes were high, but those hopes were thoroughly dashed. On Little Shell Beach, I come upon little more than scattered refuse, a work shoe covered in moss, a clutch of Mylar party balloons in varying states of deflation, dozens of what appeared to be golden delicious apples, a 50-pound bag of jasmine rice from Thailand, a large bundle of what looked like heavy-duty cargo netting, some Portuguese man-o-wars, an enormous moon jelly, a metal cooler much bigger than a standard refrigerator, and way too many of what I've always called sea onions, but may actually be bits of invasive water hyacinth washed down from the many rivers that empty into the Gulf. From a distance, these little devils can look a lot like lightning whelks, which led me to eventually change their unofficial name to false whelk. By the time I reached mile marker 15, I had in my possession one unimpressive common arc and one nice angel wing. It was a disappointing haul for as much beach as I had combed, but there was always tomorrow, which would bring with it another 20 miles of opportunity. It was about 7 o'clock when I reached Kenny and Paul, who had pulled the vehicles up to the dunes and unpacked the coolers, set up a canopy and a tent, unfolded some chairs, and collected firewood. I felt good. My legs were, as I expected, tired, and my dogs were, as expected, barking. But overall, I had, to my pleasant surprise, held up pretty well. Soon after I settled in, we were joined by a curious and very bold coyote who sauntered all around our campsite, trotting back and forth between us and the water, and even went so far as to dig at one of Paul's bocce balls just 20 or so yards away. As the sky began to pinken, the three of us, sans coyote, climbed a large dune to watch the sun set over the Laguna Madre and the flat coastal plain beyond. The portion of the island behind the sandy fore dunes, which stretches no more than a couple miles at the park's widest point, is covered in fields of brownish-green grassy dunes and sprinkled with yellowish mudflats. The glimmering Laguna Madre is visible off in the distance, and there are no man-made objects in sight. The moist, light-diffusing Gulf air, coupled with the wispy clouds, turn the whole sky brilliant shades of orange, pink, and blue. It was gorgeous. For dinner, we had grilled chicken tacos with sautéed veggies and Oreos for dessert. Then we retired to the campfire, where we talked about the day and how lucky we were to have made it to the coast. There was a new moon that night, and the dark and mostly clear skies, coupled with our remote location, made for excellent stargazing. A hint of city light from Corpus Christi to the north was evident, but even so, the stars were spectacular. I used to believe that nothing could beat a full moon rising over the Gulf of Mexico, so big and bright that as teenagers, we'd sometimes swim in its glow. But beneath this evening's moonless South Texas sky, astronomical show we witnessed rivaled even the famous ones of far west Texas. Just a couple of vehicles passed us in either direction, mostly fishermen coming and going. It had been as good of an evening as it had been a day, but after a few freshly mixed palomas and a few beers, it was time to turn in. Crawled into the back of my SUV, where, because of the steady gusting winds, I decided to bed down instead of in the tent I'd brought. The back gate of the vehicle was open toward the ocean, and as I lay there, I felt a touch of trepidation. The first day had gone well, but there were 45 more miles yet to go. I had never in my 53 years attempted anything like this. Wasn't sure how I'd feel after another 20 miles and another 25 miles after that. Was I up to it? I wasn't sure, but as the weariness settled in, I mostly felt happy to be where I was, and the susurration of the wind and the crashing waves soon sent me off to sleep. Next section is day two. This is now March 24th. He'll be moving from mile marker 15 to mile marker 35. As I awoke at daybreak, the winds had calmed, but the sound of the surf was still crashing pleasantly against my ear. It was a few minutes before the sun would rise above the watery horizon, and the partly cloudy sky was a vivid blend of pink and light blue. I sat up in my sleeping bag, taking it in. Just then, I noticed a movement out of the corner of my eye. A coyote friend, an early riser, was already up and about. Even more bold than he had been the evening before, he, having grown up on too many Roadrunner cartoons, I think of all coyotes as he, was right there in our camp, just outside my vehicle, sniffing around for spilled taco fillings and Oreo bits, no doubt. He moved on when he noticed me noticing him, but I didn't really see the wily critter again. Once up, I had some of Paul's strong pour-over coffee and took a dip in the butt-clenchingly chilly water, which was so clear that as the waves swelled just before breaking, the early sunlight rendered them the color of old Coke bottle glass, translucent with a green hue. After breakfast, fruit, protein bars, and dried sausage, dusted off the sand, it was everywhere, from my personal gear and packed up. Then, mindful of blister-producing irritants, carefully brushed the sand from my feet and toes and put on my socks and shoes. After applying sunscreen and loading my day pack, I thanked Kenny and Paul in advance for breaking down camp, and I headed out. Just a half mile or so beyond our campsite, I passed a notch in the foredunes, marking the entrance to a four-wheel drive only road that leads to Yarborough Pass, a primitive campground on the Laguna Madre side of the island. Many assume that the pass, which was dredged in 1941 and filled back in decades ago, was named after U.S. Senator Ralph Yarborough. It wasn't. It was named for W.O. Yarborough, a member of the Texas Game, Fish, and Oyster Commission, a precursor to the Texan Parks and Wildlife Department. Even so, Senator Yarborough was instrumental in the formation of PINS, introducing the initial legislation calling for its establishment in 1958. 10 years later, Smiling Ralph, as folks called him, was among the many dignitaries present at the park's dedication. Eddie Bird Johnson spoke before a reported crowd of 10,000 and then partook in a fish fry and a barefoot stroll along the beach. A few years after that, my dad, my brothers, and I were driving to the Fort Mansfield Channel in our brand-new bright orange Ford Bronco when my dad had the idea to escape the soft beach sand, which was difficult to drive on, and make his way to Yarborough Pass via this road, where he planned to take advantage of what he thought would be the more easily drivable mud flats, an endeavor that is forbidden today. When the Bronco, with all four wheels in drive, began to sink in the mud, my brothers were ordered out to push. I was young, maybe 7 or 8, but I remember the event mostly because it was the first time I recall my dad cussing, and the only time I remembered him cussing for such an extended period of time. The particulars are lost to me now, but we eventually made it back to the beach and down to the channel. As I continued my walk, the sun grew more intense and the southerly winds in my face were beginning to pick up. The beach conditions were still great, though, and I looked forward to Big Shell Beach, which I told myself isn't called Big Shell for nothing. I knew from studying maps that by the time I'd passed mile marker 20, I had entered Big Shell. There are no signs announcing any of the various beaches. Sadly, there would have been no way to tell otherwise. This beach looked just like all the others, rich in scenic beauty, but nearly devoid of collectible seashells. There were occasional bits of shells that may have been big at one time, but there were no big shells. I continued to come across the usual and unusual human detritus, more Mylar party balloons, assorted bottles of varying usages, foods, wine, soy sauce, perfume, etc., inoperable cigarette lighters, a few more balls and small buoy-type objects that also resembled Wilson, who I continued to greet with enthusiasm. I also passed large tree limbs and tree trunks. Eventually, I did come across some small shells, but few worth picking up. Take a little break here and remind you, you're listening to Texas Monthly Magazine, Sight and Sound Broadcasting. This year marks over 50 years of enriching the lives of individuals with visual, physical, and perceptual disabilities. You can listen to Sight and Sound on one of our specially tuned radios, channel 8.5 on TV, streaming on your computer or mobile device, or listening at your convenience on our archives page. We are Sight and Sound Radio since 1967. Back to our text. Though I felt I'd found my stride, walking for hours at a time on a beach without shells and the usual throngs of people and canopies and beach umbrellas can get monotonous. Luckily, I find such ambulatory monotony comforting. I'm a walker. I take evening walks around my Austin neighborhood a few nights a week and long walks around Lady Bird Lake almost as frequently. It's likely that I picked up this habit from my dad. Even in the early 70s, before the fitness movement had turned walking into a craze, he would have my mom drive him 10 or 15 miles outside of Temple and he'd walk home. He occasionally remarked that he had enjoyed marching during World War II when he was in Italy with the Army's 10th Mountain Division, whose informal motto was Semper Avanti, always forward. And he would sometimes lament the loss of his Army boots, which he had apparently hung on to for a good while after the war. I should have had them bronzed, he'd say. I suspect that my dad liked walking for the same reason that I do. Once my legs are in motion, my mind clears itself of the mundane thoughts that often crowd it. Chore lists, grocery lists, calendar entries, lunch options, and always looming deadlines. Whenever I walk, my dad always crosses my mind. Would he be proud of me and the choices I've made in my life? I think of my kind-hearted mother, too. Would she be worried about me, walking all this way? On this particular day, I also thought about my late brother, Joe, who was the real outdoorsman of the family. He would have insisted on coming along on this trip, mainly for the adventure, but also for the opportunity to fish. I thought about my wife, Kendall, and Sarah, and reassured myself that they're both strong women who, even amidst a burgeoning pandemic, can take care of themselves just fine without me. I also thought about the many, many miles of beach still in front of me. By this point, the wind had picked up and was probably blowing at a sustained 25 miles an hour with much stronger gusts. On top of that, I had encountered areas where the sand was less densely packed. The combination made walking fairly arduous. I was glad to pass mile marker 25 and see Kenny and Paul up ahead with lunch and a shady canopy. After refueling on sausage wraps with cheese and resting and shooting the breeze for a while, I started back at it. The wind was still blowing, but hey, semper avanti. People, already scarce, grew scarcer still. During the whole of day two, I probably encountered a half dozen souls, not counting Kenny and Paul and the coyote. I'd walked for hours without anyone in sight. I was alone. I was very alone. Unless we're counting birds. We're counting birds, I wasn't alone at all. I encountered thousands of seagulls and hundreds of pelicans, as well as numerous sandpipers, including the long-billed curlew, a migrator that can be seen on the Texas shore in the winter. Mixed groups of birds would be loitering at the water's edge, and as I'd approach, they'd get spooked and take off, only to alight a little farther down the beach. It felt like a game until they'd tire of it and fly off out of sight. I saw long-legged egrets and herons, ducks and geese, grackled sparrows, hawks and buzzards. The buzzards, always alone, would come gliding at high speed down the trough that runs between the foredunes and larger sand dunes behind them, taking advantage of the strong tailwind and skillfully riding updrafts that I suspect were created by the foredune. I wondered how they'd learned to do that, and I wondered what they thought of me. Were they waiting for me to drop so they could make a meal of my ample remains? For a moment, I allowed myself to dream. What if I were a bird, able to spread my wings wide, take flight, ride the wind, instead of having to slog along the beach by foot? Late in the afternoon, as I, earthbound, plodded winglessly southward, I looked up and out at the horizon and had a somewhat startling sensation. I felt that I was taller, perhaps 2 feet taller than my actual 5'10". When I looked back down, the distance from my eyes to my feet seemed greater than usual. It was a strange feeling, but not at all unpleasant. I suspect that the illusion had something to do with the relative flatness of the horizons I was surrounded by, the ocean to the east, the coastal plain to the west, and the long ribbon of sand before and behind me. Much as I sometimes have the uncanny feeling of moving forward in a parked car when the car next to me pulls out backwards, my surroundings had played a trick on my inner eye, making me feel like the Big Tex of the Gulf Coast. The Karankawa Indians, among the first known human visitors to the island, were said to have been a tall people, reportedly 6 to 7 feet, which, in my solitude-fueled state of loopiness, made me wonder if I was experiencing a mild case of possession. Maybe I was going a little crazy. I kept walking. Thinking of the Karankawa prompted me to think, too, about the other early inhabitants that followed them. Over the past 5 centuries, this rugged portion of the island has been occupied not just by coastal Native American, but by Spanish sailors, Mexican and Anglo ranchers, and the U.S. military. The Spanish explorer Alonso Alvarez de Pineda first mapped the area in 1519, naming the island Isla Blanca, White Island, a nod to the same white sandy beaches upon which I was walking. His fellow Spaniard, Alvar Nunez Cabeza de Vaca, likely passed through the area a few years after Pineda, though there is no evidence that either man had made his way onto the island. In 1543, Spain's Moscoso expedition sailed by the island on its way from the mouth of the Mississippi River to Veracruz, but again, there's no record of the group coming ashore. A decade later, in 1554, 3 Spanish vessels succumbed to a storm and ran aground in the present-day Port Mansfield Channel. The Santa Maria de Isiar, the Espiritu Santo, and the San Esteban carried passengers and crew numbering some 300. It is thought that half to two-thirds of them drowned in the accident. Those who made it to shore represent the first documented non-natives who have visited the island. More than 2 centuries later, in the early 1800s, the Mexican priest and rancher Padre José Nicolás Bailly procured the original grant to the island from the Spanish crown, launching a first real settlement of the island. It is from Padre Bailly that the island takes its current name. After his death in 1829, the land was retained by the Bailly family but sold off in portions over the years. In the late 1800s, Corpus Christi native Patrick Dunn, who had been a free-range cattleman until the arrival of barbed wire closed off the open range, set up his own ranching operations here. Surrounded by water on 3 sides, Dunn only needed to fence off the southern end of his sandy spread, which he did somewhere in the vicinity of the current Port Mansfield Channel. As it was for the Bailly's, the grazing was good. His cattle fed on the plentiful grasses, and there was abundant fresh water. And though Dunn, in 1926, sold his land to Colonel Sam Robertson, who was interested in turf development, he retained mineral rights and grazing rights, and a ranching operation persisted for almost 100 years. During World War II and into the Korean War, this portion of the island was used by the Naval Air Station in nearby Corpus Christi. Padre Island was, in fact, one of the 8 candidate sites for the first nuclear bomb test. Thankfully, it lost out to a location in New Mexico. In the 60s, the land was purchased by the federal government, making way for the park that I was now traversing. Remnants of the island's early uses can still be seen. The ruins of the Novillo Line Camp, the last vestige of the Dunn operation, were located on the inland side of the park at its northern end, but aren't much to see, and unexploded ordnance is still occasionally discovered. Visitors are asked to keep clear of any unidentified metal objects protruding from the ground and report them to a ranger immediately. As I walked amid all this invisible and barely visible history, other discarded relics of humanity, both mundane and interesting, made themselves known. Hard hats, life jackets, a boxy old television, a scuba fin, a flip-flop with a flower motif, various lengths of rope, a pristine Titleist golf ball, a ping-pong ball, a single crock covered in barnacles, wine bottles and liquor bottles and beer bottles, a large red barrel, a Tonka truck wheel, a rusty car rim with a tire still on it, more cigarette lighters, more balloons, more of everything that doesn't sink to the bottom of the ocean. Just before mile marker 35, I came across an enormous loggerhead turtle carcass. Loggerheads can weigh up to 375 pounds, and though this one was in an advanced state of decomposition, it looked like it might have been that heavy. As I examined it, I could see no obvious outward cause of death, no large gashes from a boat propeller or entangling netting or fishing line, and I chose to think that the big seafarer had lived out its full 70 to 80 year lifespan swimming the oceans, happily cavorting with other sea creatures and munching on shellfish at will. A good life. I thought about my own life for a moment, and while I'm pretty sure that I've been living my best life for the past 53 years, I was certainly that I was doing it that day. At about 7 o'clock, not long after I passed the turtle's carcass, I strolled into camp. Kenny and Paul had chosen a lovely spot again at the foot of a tall dune. After prying off my shoes and enjoying a hard-earned cold Modelo, I was informed by my Apple Watch that I had set a new record of 361 exercise minutes, which was apparently 300% of my move goal. Way to go, the device encouraged me. I was duly encouraged. I was discouraged, however, by the meager collections of shells I had in my possession. There were a few colorful fragments, a couple of common hearts, sea bean, one fairly impressive cockle, one Florida spiny jewel box, a nice discocinia, and a cool specimen of brown sea glass, likely a piece of a beer bottle, upon which the faintly legible words, "Law forbids use of this bottle," were visible. Again, there would always be tomorrow. As we clambered to the top of a large dune to watch the sunset, the sense of remoteness and isolation had intensified. We were a long way from anywhere. It was 35 miles back to the park's visitor center, which was closed, and 25 miles down to the Port Mansfield Channel, which was a dead end. Inland, somewhere out there across the Laguna Madre, lay the 825,000-acre King Ranch, and, save for a few tiny communities, a whole lot of nothing. Cell phone service had been non-existent since midday the day before, but suddenly, while I was atop the dune, my phone started lighting up with messages and notifications. I had mixed feelings about making contact with the outside world. I did check the Pins Facebook page for updates, though. Malachite Campground would be closed until further notice due to the coronavirus. After dinner, we sat around a campfire, drinking and talking. It was still windy and a bit more overcast than the night before, but the opportunities for good stargazing were again plentiful. Venus, fairly low and exceptionally bright in the northwest sky, was always first to make an appearance, and then before you knew it, the entire sky filled with stars. The Milky Way was so bright it resembled cloud-like cloud cover. As I sat, I assessed the status of my physical well-being. I'd walked 42 miles in 2 days, and this day had been more difficult than the day before. Sometime after lunch, I'd stopped for a brief rest and taken my shoes off to wade in the water and walk barefoot for a while. Varying the foot feel, as I came to refer to it, seemed to help with foot fatigue. I'd walked too far barefoot, though, and felt a slight pang on the ball of my right foot. I feared a blister was forming. Other than that, I was at worst a little tired, mildly sore. I only had 25 or so miles to go. I felt confident that I was going to make it to the end, possibly even the following day. I mixed another Paloma. Midnight was approaching. And then, as we were getting ready to call it a night, we noticed headlights bobbing toward us from the north. It was late for fishermen, late for anybody, really. A truck passed right by us, but then it came to a sudden stop and backed up. We approached cautiously. A man, who appeared to be by himself, opened his door and got out. He was lanky and seemed somewhat addled. From the other side of his truck, he asked in an excited voice, "How far to the end? How far to the cut?" 25 miles, we replied in unison. That was all he needed to know. He zoomed off into the darkness. Here's the next section. It's day 3, March 25th. Mile marker 35 to mile marker 55, good 20 miles. Once again, I woke at sunrise. Although I was miles past Big Shell Beach, I held out hope for better shelling ahead. A few miles into my walk, somewhere around mile marker 40, I came upon a small shack tucked into the dunes. It was the Sea Turtle Patrol Base Camp. In less than a week, park personnel and volunteers would begin their annual 4-plus months of relentless patrolling of the beach, looking for the telltale checkmark tracks and signs of nesting kept Ridley sea turtles. Those assigned to these far reaches of the park or working the night shift sometimes opt to bunk in this simple plywood structure. But for now, the building was empty. As I walked on, I started to see more seashells, though nothing too eye-grabbing. I passed some fishermen who had just baited a line with a large stingray and were about to paddle it out by kayak to deeper water. They were angling for sharks. We exchanged nods. Past large hunks of marine debris, a massive rusty storage tank covered in colorful graffiti from visitors past, an overturned boat about 15 feet long, memorialized by a plastic hard hat atop a long pole driven into the sand. A bit farther on, I spotted a wooden cross in the dunes that appeared to be the final resting place of a beloved pet named Bo Dog. Soon, I passed a lone fisherman, a friendly young guy named Noe, from nearby Cal Allen. He fishes the surf here often, and on this day was hoping to land some Pompano, one of the Gulf's tastiest denizens. The water, cool, clear, and green, was ideal at the moment, but wouldn't last, he said. We talked for a little while. He seemed bemused by my adventure, and soon parted ways. Not long after, I encountered a few more fishermen, all northbound. We exchanged quip waves, but nothing more. As with the buzzard, I wondered what they must have thought of me, walking alone in this desolate place. I rendezvoused with Kenny and Paul in the vicinity of mile marker 45, where we scarfed down a lunch of chicken tacos, and I got some rest before shoving off again. Shelling continued to disappoint. I began to think that I was going to beachcomb a 65-mile stretch of mostly untrodden barrier island and have little more than sore muscles, blistered feet, chapped lips, chafed nether regions, and a mild sunburn to show for it. It just didn't seem possible. As I passed mile marker 50 later in the afternoon, I kept an eye toward the sea at a spot where in 1912, 6 months and one day after the Titanic went down, the SS Nicaragua, a Mexican cargo ship on its way from Tampico to Port Arthur with a load of cotton and other freight, ran aground in a hurricane, stranding some 20 crew members. Its boiler is still visible when the tide is low, a boxy black structure barely protruding from the breakers about 100 yards out. Wasn't much to see, but as I walked on, I thought about the castaways who had hoofed it 54 miles from here to Point Isabel. Nicaragua isn't the only ship to have met mishap on Padre Island. There have been many, particularly in this area, where there's a point of tidal convergence at a slight bend in the coast that has come to be known as the Devil's Elbow. The most famous are the aforementioned Santa Maria de Ixiar, Espiritu Santo, and San Esteban, whose foundering in 1554 was the worst calamity the Spanish fleet had experienced in the New World. They are also the oldest shipwrecks ever found off of the U.S. coast. In 1967, the wrecks were discovered by a private out-of-state salvaging company in the long battle over rights to the find, which included gold and silver and various artifacts, ultimately led to the enactment of the Texas Antiquities Code in 1969. By coincidence, right around that time, the members of the troubled Courtney expedition, the one involving the bright orange Bronco and my dad's profligate cussing, discovered a grounded shrimp boat in the waters just offshore. This wreckage held no riches, but, if memory serves, provided the expedition's members with the opportunity to swim out to it and swing off of a rope dangling from one of the damaged vessel's yardarms. Reeling in my decades-old memories, I came upon a treasure of a different kind. There, on a beach that didn't even include the word shell in its name, was an enormous patch of enormous shells, and some medium and small shells, too. It was as if the beach itself was made up of nothing but shells. Could have taken a shovel to it and overturned nothing but shells. I was dazzled by the quahogs, large clamshells similar to cockles but with a much sturdier build, plus all sorts of interesting striations. There were orange and brown ones, gray and white ones, tan and white ones, gray and bluish ones, orange and yellow ones, and blackish ones. They were big and beautiful, and it had only taken about 55 miles of walking to find them. I reluctantly winnowed down my haul to a dozen or so specimens, slipped them into my knapsack and moved on. And then, not farther along, I stumbled on another such patch. There were more quahogs and other shells too, tiny arcs, a common sundial, and even a large vertebrae from some unknown species. And there was another patch after that. The beach, from the water's edge all the way back to the dunes, was littered with shells. Soon my pack was brimming. As I walked further, something ahead caught my eye. Was it a lightning whelk, I wondered, or merely another false whelk deployed to cruelly get my hopes up? It was, in fact, a lightning whelk, and a big one at that. It was weathered, but it was a lightning whelk nonetheless. In the last 5 miles of my third day, less than 10 miles from the end of the line, my fortunes had suddenly and dramatically changed. 7 o'clock approached, I spotted Kenny and Paul. We had decided that rather than complete the trip in the dark, a somewhat risky proposition, we'd camp for the night near mile marker 55, which would leave for the morning a victorious sprint of just 5 miles. When I reached the campsite, I felt a sense of exhaustion and triumph, the likes of which I can't recall. My body was sore, my feet were blistered, but I couldn't have been happier. I popped open a beer and unloaded my booty. Kenny and Paul were duly impressed. Driving the beach with sea mist-covered windshields, they'd missed the honey holes completely. I took a restorative swim and toweled off. We enjoyed beef fajitas for dinner and ranch water cocktails and beer. As was now our evening ritual, we climbed a tall dune to watch yet another beautiful sunset, and as had happened during our previous forays, the Gulf Croton, a pretty pale green dune plant that smells like eucalyptus, put me in mind of my earliest childhood explorations and of my mom, who used to bring small clippings back to the condo for simple arrangements. As we sat around the campfire, the sky was clear and dark, and the stargazing was the best it had been the whole trip. The Milky Way was aglow from one horizon to the other. We saw shooting stars and satellites whizzing across the sky, got into an intense debate about whether a particular bright light out over the water was a star or some seafaring vessel. It was so low, it had to be a ship, I argued. We consulted a stargazing app on Paul's phone and discovered that it was, in fact, Menkent, the constellation Centaurus's brightest star. I was duly humbled. The light from Corpus Christi was undetectable here, but now there was visible light from the southwest, the Brownsville-Harlingen metro area, I figured. Climbed back up the dune to see what we could see in the dark. As we crested the sandy mound, we were surprised to see the city lights of Port Mansfield twinkling just a few miles away. We could see radio towers, something that might have been a small airport runway, and the flashing lights atop the giant turbines of the Peniscal wind farm. Then, looking south, I saw more flashing lights just offshore. At first, I thought they were fishing boats, but peering through the binoculars, I realized that they were the green and red markers at the end of Port Mansfield Channel's jetties. They were so close, just 5 miles away, at the terminus of my long trek. Up on that big dune at night, tired with a few beers and some tequila in me, I almost got a little emotional. It is now day 4, March 26. We're at mile marker 55 and heading to the Port Mansfield Channel. There's no point in denying that my last day was anticlimactic. I had only 5 of my 65 miles left to go, and there was nothing left to prove, really. I had already experienced the quiet and introspective grandeur of solitude and the frustrations of seashell-lessness, and then the joys of belated seashell fullness. The 2 or so hours I had left were a formality, like the last few minutes of a great dinner party when everyone tries to find their coats and thank the host and say goodbye to their fellow guests and reluctantly find their way out the front door, hoping that no moments of awkwardness sully all of the merry vibes. When I woke, the ocean water was again too green, too clear, and too inviting to pass up. Once again, I leaped in, though this time, with my leg muscles stiff and sore and both of my feet blistered, I limped more than leaped. Still, I emerged exhilarated. I downed a quick breakfast of trail mix and an orange, this time with a side of ibuprofen, washed down with cold brew coffee. Then Kenny and Paul wished me luck as, for the 4th morning in a row, I pointed myself south, started walking. The sun broke through the clouds early, and the sky opened up. It was the brightest day of my trip, and I soaked it all in. I looked out at the Gulf of Mexico, so vast. I looked at the tall sand dunes. I turned around and looked up the shore northward and looked ahead southward. I also cast my gaze downward. I still had a little beach left to comb, after all, and I soon came upon another rich deposit of shells, yards long and brimming with more large and colorful quahogs. Picked up a few choice ones and put them in my pack. To my surprise, I had not seen one intact sand dollar the whole trip, but in that last mile or so, I found 3 nice ones. Thousands of huge pink granite blocks that form the jetties of the Port Mansfield Channel and the southern end of the Padre Island National Seashore were visible now, protruding far out into the Gulf. Across the channel, I could see the southern portion of the island. As I made my final approach, the beach between the shore and the 4 dunes widened out, a result of the decades-long effect of the jetties that have had on the currents and tides that shift the sands. The dune grasses waved in a welcoming fanfare, and my bird friends, still up for a game of catch me if you can, provided an aerial escort. Kenny and Paul were there waiting for me, and so too was one other solitary soul, a young man who, accompanied by his dog, had dragged a small camper all the way down the island to escape the pandemic. He had talked with Paul briefly, but seemed content to maintain a healthy distance. He looked on curiously as I bent over and kissed one of the jetty's warm and salty granite blocks. I had walked for 3.5 days from Cleburne County through Kennedy County and into Willacy County. I was tired, my body was sore, but inside I felt as tall as a Karankawa. I was happy. I made it. As a sort of ceremonial exclamation mark, I made my way over the jetty's 2,000 plus feet of bulky and uneven blocks all the way out to the tip of the North Jetty. It quickly became evident that because of my blistered feet, this was not a great idea, but I proceeded foolhardily. After about 20 minutes of painful traversing, I stood at the end beneath a rusted post, atop which was one of the flashing lights that I'd spied from the dune the night before. It was a good vantage point, and I snapped a few photos of the southern portion of the island and the familiar northern portion, too. When I got back to the beach, I swam in the cool water and snacked on the food we had left. Paul tried his luck fishing but struck out, and Kenny paddled out and surfed for a while. Then the time had come. We loaded up our two vehicles, and for the first time in 4 days, headed north. We drove along the beach for 40 miles before we encountered another human being. And as I sat at the wheel of my Toyota, getting reaccustomed to the small comforts of modern automotive technology, I found myself rolling the trip around in my mind. For the better part of 4 days, sand beneath my feet, also in nooks and crannies I wasn't even aware of, I had hewed the border between the coastal wilderness of South Texas and the aquatic wilderness of the Gulf of Mexico. Between Padre Island's colorful past and a preserved portion of its largely unchanged present. On the surface, my long walk was a physical ordeal, but the minor aches and weariness aren't what have stuck with me. What has stayed with me and will stay with me for years to come is the profound sense of just how lucky I've been to get to spend so much of my life amid such a natural wonder. No, the Texas coast doesn't have the finest beaches in the world. You can't snorkel in crystal clear water, or surf a flawless Point Break, or explore sea caves, or by kayak here, but it is a place where, on the Easter weekend following my trip, the first Kemp's Ridley sea turtle nest of the year was found, a place where the next generation of turtles will, fingers crossed, begin their lives. Sempre avante! It's a place where a person can not only fish and swim and spend time with family and old friends, but he's so inclined, point himself south or north and walk an absurdly long distance. Nothing but his memories, many, many birds keep him company. It's a place I love. Mylar balloons, inoperable cigarette lighters, barnacle covered flip flops, and all. Very conveniently brings us to the end of our reading for today. You've been listening. Texas.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, Travelin' Texas, followed by Texas Gardener at 4:30.
If you're a do-it-yourselfer, don't let physical challenges limit your imagination. Each week, the guys on The Blind Handyman answer questions and offer tips on home maintenance and upgrades.
As we've pointed out several times, you do things when you're blind. Many times you do them the same way a sighted person would. A drill is a drill is a drill. A saw is a saw. And you just need to remember, don't get your fingers in it and push the board through it.
You want to make sure that your structure will support this.
We're going to talk about an email that we had gotten about a stove ignition problem.
Assuming that you're blind, John, and you can't read a voltmeter, what do you want to do there?
Most of the new ones in the high-scale reading, it'll make a buzz and all.
I'm going to talk about installing a micro hood. It's a combination microwave and vent hood.
And we've started drinking early. No, I'm not only kidding.
The Blind Handyman, direct from Lufkin, Texas. Monday nights at 7, Saturdays at noon, and Sunday nights at 11 on Recording Library of West Texas Radio.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 94 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the upper 70s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the low 90s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the upper 70s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Coronavirus updates, weekdays at 1.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 4 p.m.
Hello and welcome to our program. My name is Lynette McLamory, and I'll be reading Travelin' Texas here on Sight and Sound Radio. For today's program, I'll be reading articles from the August issue of Texas Highways, and I'll start out with the open road essay titled In the Belly of the Whale. A down-on-his-luck wanderer searches for answers on the lonely coastline of the Golden Triangle, by John Nova Lomax. By any standard, I should have been content. I had a prestigious magazine job. I was married to the woman of my dreams. My son, John Henry, was thriving in the Army, and my daughter was doing very well in junior high. And yet, I was drowning myself in alcohol. With every light on my instrument panel flashing red, in January 2019, I quit yelling at the ocean and consented to treatment. Emerging a month later with a diagnosis of acute, long untreated PTSD, I blinked back at the wider world, fully sober for the first time in a decade. I got in my 2003 Honda Accord and went off in search of something I would find along the way. At the time, I was half-heartedly participating in Alcoholics Anonymous, and my choice of higher power teetered between St. Francis of Assisi and my own ancestors. St. Francis eventually receded into the shadows as I committed to a crude form of ancestor worship. It seemed rational, scientific. We are, to some degree, who our genes command us to be. In knowing who I came from, in coming to know the ghosts who made me, perhaps I could find new strength and wisdom. Chasing those phantoms took me as far as Mississippi and the Shenandoah Valley in Virginia. But the search bore the most bountiful harvest very close to my Houston home, in the storm-racked and lonely coastline of the Golden Triangle, framed by Beaumont, Port Arthur, and Orange. There, the seafaring people of my maternal grandmother, Charlotte Ann Susie Plummer Taylor, settled back in the late 1830s. They'd had an outsized influence on my life, both by nature and nurture. To steep myself in their lore was key to understanding both who I had been before rehab and who I would like to be after. To know this salty bunch better, I moved to the beach on Follett's Island, just west of San Luis Pass. There I lived sparsely in the Accord, sleeping in the reclined passenger seat next to a clump of salt cedars. I made that grove my own and established a routine, rising with the dawn and watching the sun ascend amber and purple from the Gulf waters. Then I'd drive a mile or two down the beach, scattering sanderlings, gulls, and oyster catchers along the way to an access point for the Blue Water Highway. I'd grab a coffee and a taco and check myself into a cubicle at Freeport's Public Library, where I'd work on magazine stories all day long. By night, I saw myself as a high-tech Karankawa tribesman. As the moon rose and bathed the gulf in glittery white light, I'd listen to the wind and waves as I conjured the ghosts of Plummer's past via genealogy apps on my iPhone. Soothed by the unending subtleties of the ocean power, it was easy to feel close to my Plummer folks. I'd long been steeped in Plummer legend, thanks to my now 94-year-old grandmother, Susie, the first daughter in four consecutive generations of ship captains. Susie would sit in her big four-poster bed in our rambling old home in Houston, dogs at her feet and a needlepoint canvas in her hands, and resurrect the salty phantoms of our heritage in her lilting, old-timey, coastal Southeast Texas accent. Her clan's lineage hung on the wall in a needlepoint sampler knitted by her maiden aunt, Julia Plummer, the longtime head librarian at Lamar University. Aunt Julia had lived some of these stories and heard others from her own Aunt Jessie, the first of the Texas Gulf Coast plumber lady storytellers. In the fullness of time, those picturesque tales came to resemble, in my mind, the magical realism of Gabriel Garcia Marquez, only with the Golden Triangle as our Macondo, and our plumber family its Buendias. My family's stories had it all. Infidelity, pestilence, shipwrecks, war, incest, alcoholism, heroism, reversals of fortune, and harrowing nights of terror amid the roiling waters and howling winds of the great storm of 1900, and slightly lesser tempests. One windswept night on Follett's Island, I decided that in order to better bring these stories in my head to life, I would have to go to my ancestors' old stomping grounds on the salt-crusted rim of the Golden Triangle. I found little trace of the family's presence in either Beaumont or Port Arthur, the two cities they reluctantly settled in after the hurricanes of 1886, 1900, and 1915, finally chased them from the Gulf's very edge. My great-great-grandfather, Captain Fred Plummer's fine old home in Beaumont's South Park neighborhood, was long gone. Dotted as that land is with grassy vacant lots, a boarded-up warehouse or two, and crumbling old homes, it was hard to recall the time when the neighborhood bustled with life, spilling over from the port of Beaumont, mere blocks away. Aside from 39 plumber graves in Magnolia Cemetery, about all that tangibly remains of my family in Beaumont is a reading room in Lamar's library, named after Aunt Julia. This absence goes double for Port Arthur, and especially its city center, where the A now hangs crookedly from the lettering on the former Port Arthur News building. The paper, along with much of the rest of the economic life of the city, decamped north of State Highway 87, or to satellite towns such as Groves, Nederland, and Port Neches. Downtown was forlorn. On my first visit, trees grew out of the windows of the abandoned federal building's top floor. This was not the Port Arthur Captain Howard Plummer, my great-grandfather, had known, but it wasn't all suburban flight and urban decay. In the old part of town, a Baptist church had been repurposed as the Bumon Buddhist Temple. Refinery giant Motiva was transforming three of the city center's grand old edifices, including that federal building, into office space. And the city's splendid Museum of the Gulf Coast, and you have the makings of a stunning turnaround. "If you can save Port Arthur, you can save the world," said my friend Kevin Russell, a Beaumont native and Austin musician, better known as Shiny Ribs. This was not long after he closed out a raucous summer 2019 homecoming show at Corville's Kitchen, near the rice fields west of Beaumont, with his lovely, seldom-played Raining in Port Arthur. I had been rattling off to him many of the town's problems, among them coastal erosion brought on in part by global warming, and the endless parade of ever more vicious storms blowing off the Gulf. Save Port Arthur, save the world. If this was possible, I thought to myself, it was possible I could save myself. When that epiphany hit me, I was standing on the levee close enough to Port Arthur's docks to hear the hypnotic thrum of the idling engines of a tanker at anchor. This was very near the site of the Plummer family's grand triumph back in March 1910. The story of the Port Arthur Moby Dick has been told and retold many times over the past century plus, but likely never more skillfully than by Texas adventurer and writer Gayne Young. In a 2019 article for Sporting Classics magazine, Young described the ghost-gray hide, worn from age and heavily scarred from decades of fights with deep-roaming squid and battles with rival males competing for breeding rights. Young went on about how an overzealous pursuit of a school of squid had mired the whale atop a shallow sandbar in the old oil pond, a huge natural oil slick of unknown origins that once floated off Sabine Pass before it mysteriously vanished shortly after absorbing the whale. near that muck, Captain Cod Plummer, brother of my great-great-grandfather, Fred Plummer, was at the helm of his steam tug dubbed Florida. Off in the distance, he saw a tremendous commotion, geysers of mud and water flying up from the Gulf waters. Thinking it was a ship in distress, Cot set course for the ruckus and found not a ship, but a sperm whale, 63 feet long and weighing 65 tons. Naturally, Cot had to catch it and tow it to port. But how? It turns out snaring a whale is not unlike roping a steer. After the whale snapped a series of smaller ropes, Cot tied a hawser, a giant rope used to moor tankers, around the animal's tail, just above the fins, and set the Florida on course for harbor. The whale had other plans, though. It fought back hard, and at times yanking the Florida in reverse, despite the best efforts of the steam tug's 350-horsepower engine. 5 hours later, they'd made the 8 miles to dock, and there the circus began. News of the Leviathan crackled through telegraph wires coast to coast. Amazed locals jostled to be first in line to see the still barely living monster of the deep. Soon the small town was overwhelmed with visitors from nearby towns. So, for ease of access to the public, the whale was towed to Port Arthur, but it died along the way. Upon arrival, its carcass was hoisted out of the water and crudely embalmed. Crews of men shoveled ice into the whale's body cavity in an effort to stave off the inevitable, and the whale was tastefully illuminated. The first day the whale was on display, about 400 people plunked down 50 cents